is somewhat formidable to be in a pulpit that has had so many great ones in it. And I want to say at 52, it's not getting any better. For me, I'm not getting any less nervous as I get older. And naturally, one has to be honest. Even the best of preachers and the most godly of people, when they face special challenges and special places like this one, go through all sorts of convolutions of thought beforehand as what you're going to talk about. I wondered whether I should, in fact, come dressed up tonight. If I was speaking at a conference of high flyers, I probably would have a pinstripe suit on. But I want to tell you why I haven't tonight. It's because this is the Church of Jesus Christ, and I refuse to conform to the standards of this world. And I want to come to you and speak to you from my heart tonight. I've just come from a gathering of probably 35,000 people who are no different to you or me. I sat in the tired, beleaguered remains of a morning where the night had been badly spent by thousands of people. And with the eggs and bacon and baked beans, watched some of those who had probably not slept at all last night. Mothers, fathers, little children. I became a granddad 18 months ago. It's changing my life. I'm really starting to understand that the Australian Aboriginals probably are the only group in our country, from the sociology departments of the universities to the streets, that have any idea why Western culture is disintegrating. Because for them, the old people and the children are what really matter. Because the old people have the wisdom about the things that really matter. I'm not talking about technology. I'm talking about relationships, mystery, wonder, sense of meaning in life. And the children of the future. We talk the words, but we have no feeling for it. They do. And I guess what I've been at the last couple of days is very tribal. This morning, as we're sitting at the table eating this absolutely inglorious mishmash of breakfast, I saw a mother and a father, bikers, with a gorgeous little girl sitting on the table. I don't know whether she was awake all night, but the parents were looking pretty tired, and the little one was just so gorgeous. And they were feeding her and giving her a drink, and she was sitting there wide-eyed at this amazing scene of wild people having their breakfast. And I couldn't resist it. I got up and stopped talking to my mates and just went over and I said, just to make conversation, I've become a granddad recently, and I looking at your little one, it's just so gorgeous. What's her name? And she said, her name's Harmony. And I said, well, she looks like she lives her name. And they said, she does. She's never any trouble. You know, we put people in boxes. Both ends do it. The rich do it, the poor do it. But when I pick up the Gospels, I see something so totally radical in Jesus. And I know the word radical is a tired old word. I don't know another word to use. But I don't feel satisfied with the evangelical tradition, whether its doctrines are right or not, even though I agree with its doctrines. For the simple reason that I have to say it is rare that I find people who preach the evangelical gospel who in any way live a life that disregards all of the rules of circumstance and finance and all the rest. I find few who have the opportunity and ability to have power and privilege, who, like Jesus, are friends of, not preachers to, friends of publicans and sinners and other outcasts. And I guess I take seriously the words of Jesus when he said, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Because, you see, I know I have a good education. I'm an ex-high school teacher. I have good breeding. I'm a Methodist minister's son. Not quite as good as the Anglican, perhaps, but it's not bad. It's not bad. You know, slightly rebellious Anglican, okay. I know all of that. And I know that I can't be in solidarity with the poor, because the moment I get hungry, I got options. I know if I want to look as though I don't know somebody who's scruffy in a situation, I can walk away from it, as long as my daughters aren't around. My daughter's a rascal. She's a real rebel. Loves the Lord, and recently she got married to the chief of our creative operations within our work, and she and he, Keith, added to their vows some special word. They said, "In view of the gospel, before God and these people, we promise that we will open our homes to the poor, the marginalized, and the broken. And because we know that this will put great stress on our marriage, we call upon you as our friends to support us and to strengthen us, so that our marriage can survive the impact of the promises we make this day to God." Well, you know, I'm pretty good at relating to rough events and that kind of thing, but I was in New Zealand, and my daughter chose to have her honeymoon in New Zealand. And I was meeting with two very important executive people, one of whom was the lady who was the celebrity speakers person for New Zealand. She was tying up the knots of some very good speaking opportunities, you know, the kinds of ones that are good for our organization because they bring in thousands of dollars for a 40-minute address. Just the right. And we were in the 5-star hotel in a nice lounge area upstairs, and all of a sudden, to my absolute horror, I see this totally casually dressed, barefoot girl on the other side of the lounge, strides across without any introduction, grasps my hand and says, "The Reverend Smith, I've wanted to have a lengthy conversation with you for years." It was my daughter. And I guess she wouldn't do that if she didn't think I could cope with it. And some of you will be horrified at that. It'll give you nightmares tonight to think of your kids doing that. But you know, I thank God for that. I mean, my instruction to her would be different. I would say, "Daughter, don't buck the system too much. It'll bite your face off. Be wise, be cunning." All of that I teach my children. But I'm glad of those moments. For I know that within the human heart is such longing for power and privilege, even in born-again Christians, that there are moments when one would gladly not have one's children there in certain situations sometimes. The chapter we had read to us tonight, I find devastating. I don't think the liberals are always wrong. I'm an evangelical. I belong in this kind of place. But the liberals haven't got it all wrong. The study of the New Testament text has certainly brought to our attention in the last century or two the fact that the Gospels are not simply little homilies that tell stories of Jesus to stir our hearts, but rather that they are the theology of the early church. And that rather than being some kind of Western chronological historical document, they are vignettes from the life of Jesus. After all, the scriptures themselves tell us that if everything was to be given to us of what Jesus did in the sort of library size of the libraries of those days, there wouldn't be room on the shelves for all the books. We have a few little pictures, few cameos from the life of Jesus, which are in a flow of an understanding of grace and of God's radical love towards fallen humanity. And in this particular one, it would seem that Mark, I think the scholars are right about this, that Mark has in mind some imagery, gives a hint about what we call grace. The crossing of the lake is an image that says something. It's at the heart of the whole story of Jesus. If you're not a church person here today, the sad thing is that you may happen to have experiences of religious people that don't in any way reflect the reality of the gospel of Jesus. You may have struck a Christian at a bad moment. You might have struck somebody who normally is very Christ-like, but they were just absolutely frazzled that day, and they treated you like you didn't matter, and you said, well, if that's Christianity, you can keep it. And sadly, all of us have our moments when we fail to walk the way we should. But if you go back to the life we follow, Jesus himself, the image of Jesus getting in the boat and going to the other side of the lake is far more powerful than our Western culture would ever show us. For on the other side of the lake are the non-Jews. And it seems a good deal of the later scholarship would indicate that the place Jesus goes across the lake here is not only the place of the non-Jews, it's not only the place where they have pig farms, which is hardly good stuff for good Jews. But it is also a place we would understand now where there was positioned one of the major military outposts of the Roman Empire. If ever anything could be aggravating to a Jew, that would be it. Conquered by these pagan pork-eating renegades who have a huge encampment on the other side of the lake. If that be the case, if that particular scholastic view is right, it explains something later on. But I want to start to say tonight, my friends, I doubt even in the church we have grasped the nature of what it is for a God, a holy God, to cross the lake, to enter into the encampment, as it were, of sin in human history. I think this image is deliberate. I think the stories are brought together the way they are. When you go to cross the other side of the lake, there's storms. The end of the story, the guy is asked to stay on the other side. We'll come to that later. But there's some wonderful imagery here. And I want to begin by challenging you as believers today. I know we have departments of evangelism. I know we send money to Rwanda. I know we do all of that. But the average rank-and-file believer doesn't really cross many lakes at all, even in their entire lifetime. We basically stay where we feel secure and safe. And my message to you is, I want to say that if you want to understand the gospel, if you want to get close to Jesus, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You see, I don't really want the kingdom of heaven, because the kingdom of heaven, I'm quite sure, is a kingdom of justice and mercy and love. We'd all agree about that in theological theory. But if that were the case, it would be a radical change for most of my kind of person. I may have one less television set. And probably a lot less privilege. I don't like it the way it is. I hate those pictures on television. And I really think the world shouldn't be such a nasty place. It would be nice to clean it up. But the basic shape, I'm quite happy about. You see, you don't long for the kingdom of God when the kingdoms of this world are doing you quite well, thank you very much. There's no desperation that you will hear in the black music of the slave. We love to sing that stuff because it's got soul and it stirs something within us. But it's secondhand. If you've never known what it is to be out of control of your life and to suffer and to know you have no handles on it anymore, if you've never known that, there is only one other way you could ever really sense what the kingdom of God is about. And that is that the Spirit of God somehow overrides all normal human contingencies. And usually the way that will happen is that God will place you in a position where you are able to borrow the eyes of someone who knows just exactly how bad this system really is. I go to the poor and I say, give me your eyes. Tell me what you see. Tell me what you feel. And don't have to feel that politically you've got to hold back on what you really think. We mostly don't know what people down there really think. They've got to survive. They've learnt ways to say the right things at the right time. When Jesus came into this world, it was like crossing the lake from the Jewish sector to the pagan Roman sector on the other side. I remember years ago I was asked to take a wedding, a Hell's Angels concert wedding. I won't go into it because I'll lose too much time. It's quite a fascinating and lengthy story, but eventually I decided to take this wedding. I'd sat with the couple, sorted out why they wanted to get married. They'd lived de facto for years. Why they wanted me to do it when they had a Catholic background. All of that we worked out. We had 6 lessons of preparation, including real looking at the whole question of where God fits into marriage. All of that was done. And they were to be married in front of 7,000 or 8,000 bikers on the platform of the Hell's Angels concert. We worked out why that was happening too. They were the only people that had cared for them. No one else had. The guy had a withered arm because a man in a Mercedes one day, as drunk as could be, was on the wrong side of the road and was smashed straight into him head on a 4-lane highway going the opposite direction. But he had the right connections, so he was never charged with anything. But this poor guy lost his arm for life. It's a sad kind of a case, but the wedding day was about to come, and suddenly the night before, I got cold feet. Now, it's to stand up there in front of 7,000 or 8,000 raging bikers and to read from the scriptures, love is gentle, love is kind, love is not arrogant, isn't really that easy. And there was a measure of concern about that, but do you know what my greatest fear was? My greatest fear was the evangelical establishment of my city. I was far more scared of that. Because I could hear some of my friends saying, why do you belittle marriage by being involved in a ceremony at such a place? And I did the old terrible thing that always means you haven't got faith when you look for a sign from the Lord. Signs mean you're not willing to follow the clear instructions he's already given you. And so you ask him to give some dew on this and some dry on that and all that kind of thing. So I did that and I opened my Bible and it came open to this verse. Whither shall I flee from thy presence, though I make my bed in hell? Thou art there. You ever really stop to think what that verse is saying? If you're not a believer tonight, and you kind of think that God's remote up there while Rwandan tragedies are occurring on planet Earth, read the Psalms. Feel the agony of the very heart of God. Though I make my bed in hell, thou art there. I want to say to you, my friend, there is not one place you can go where the grace and love of God does not pursue you with tears. And I doubt we've grasped that, even those of us that say we believe our Bibles. Does that shake you from day to day? Remember the old poem, The Hound of Heaven? I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways. Remember that? We used to learn that in high school. That's how religious it was when I was young. Thompson's wonderful poem. The God of Jesus and Jesus, our God, will pursue us down every labyrinthine way. So I went the next day to take the wedding. And it was a great day. My friends, Jesus will cross any lake, any cultural barrier, anything that mankind may erect, Jesus will cross to reach you. It's one thing to have the doctrine. It's another thing to feel that. To really feel that. Maybe if we spent a little more time out of our comfort zones, we would see him doing it. And we we would understand. On the other side of the lake was a man who represented everything that from a Jewish point of view you would have to reject. Now we have in our church back in Melbourne, this time I think 5 paedophiles in our congregation. And we have diaconate meetings, elders meetings, where we struggle with this whole thing and we say, how are we going to control this thing? And so we have to have some people who will act as elders that every week you've got to pursue. And if these guys suddenly flip out in the middle of the church service, and somebody in authority will flip out and just make sure there's not a little thing going on where some guy's trying to get a hold of one of our kids. But I'm not going to chuck them out of my church. We're not going to chuck them out of our church. Because I believe the grace of God can touch them just as much as anybody else. But I can take you to whole echelons of people who find the Christian church almost impossible to get into. They're not always poor. Some of them are jazz and blues singers who have a pretty earthy kind of view of life. And they can't kind of fit the normative shapes of church. Because the style of our Christian lives is not really lived out like a jazz piece of music. You know, with your jazz, you've got your main score, but you never quite know how it's going to come out next time. There's real movement around the edge of the thing. And there isn't in most of our Christian lives. They're predictable from the moment we get up till the moment we go to bed. If we get hit with a problem from somebody that's a bit of a rascal out there, we've got a standardized answer. And we don't even really listen very much at all to those who don't believe what we believe, because why would we expect to learn anything from them? On the other side of the lake is a man who represents everything the Jews reject. And what we have is a confrontation of prejudice and the power of the evil one. You see, this man is a man who's possessed of demons. The Pharisees believed in demons. They were really quite some fundamentalists. They believed in angels, demons, life after death, the verbal inspiration of the Torah, the absolute reliability of it, that studying the Word of God as they understood that part of the Scriptures was more important than any other task you could do. They believed in giving to the poor. They gave to the Lord's work. They loved going to prayer meetings. They were assiduous about Bible study. I think they'd probably have got into most evangelical churches pretty easy for full membership. But Jesus had to say of them, they were of their father the devil. Somehow or other, something had gone wrong. Being right, being pure, was more important than being in relationship with either God or one's fellow human being. They believed all this stuff. They believed in the spirits, but a man that's demon-possessed, what kind of company would he be to keep? A man who's socially disorderly, when their understanding of the cosmos was one of a theocracy where everything had to fit, everything had to be tight, where your doctrine had to be so exact that they had to work out 600 different things that you couldn't do on the Sabbath without breaking that particular law. How do you handle a man who no one can control, who you chain up and he breaks the chains? Totally socially disruptive. Besides that, a man who's naked. And besides that, a man who lives in tombs. I mean, no priest could go there. Any priest under the order of the time of Jesus, if you were to come within just a meter or two of a dead body, you were unclean. You'd have to go through a fortnight ceremony of cleansing before you could ever do the service of God again. This man represents in symbolism everything that would be rejected by the Jewish enclave. And I believe, as Mark brings us the story, I know some of my Pentecostal friends would just dramatize this and say that it's just a story that tells that Jesus can throw out demons. I think that's too simple. This is a story that is dealing again and again, as Mark does, with the nature of the gospel challenging the values of the world in which we live, in which God, in his grace and love for us, will brook no barrier. The God of this world is not afraid by being tainted by our sin. In fact, he goes to a cross, and Paul says, he who knew no sin became sin for us. I don't understand that, but I know it's not a God that's afraid of getting his hands dirty. I know it's not a God that's afraid of moving in to the presence of those who suffer from sinfulness and brokenness. I know it's a God that's very different to the way I often behave, and it's certainly a God very different to the way I would say the majority of professing Christians behave. Can I ask you honestly, what is the type of behavior, what is the type of personal scenario, and what is the situation which, if I really were to sit down and talk with you, you would say, I would never go into that situation. I would never sit down and talk to that kind of person. I would give up on this kind of person. We all need to think that through, my friend. Because this man represents all that a good, holy Jew would have to depart from. Jesus steadfastly takes his disciples across that lake and heads for a showdown with the forces that have destroyed this man's life. Well, we all know what happened. It was read to us tonight. Jesus confronts the demons. The demons are cast out. And they're sent to the pigs. I don't want to be too controversial. This may be a little much for you here, I don't know. But I'm inclined to believe some of those socio-political commentators who really believe there's great significance in this. I had a debate in our own city with a man by the name of Professor Singer, who's probably the world leader of the animal liberation movement. And we had a debate at Monash University in a mission we had there with about 800 students and various academics there on the subject of whether you needed God to construct an ethical and moral framework of justice in the society. Now, that's his strength. He's a philosopher, and he's an atheist, very much so, a utilitarian. And we had a vigorous debate. And, you know, in the middle of the debate, he suddenly pulled out an authorized version of the Bible. It was kind of quaint. And in the most fundamentalist way, he suddenly started quoting this story. Of course, he'd got it from Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian. And he was lifting that out of the 1950s, and he used that as a major attack. He said it goes simply like this. If Jesus really is God, then he will, and you believe God is ethical, moral, and good, then if Jesus can be shown to be unethical, immoral, and not good, then automatically the entire edifice of Christianity collapses. Would you agree? And this is the story, of course, above all others that an animal liberationist would most quickly pull out of the hat. He said, Jesus precociously takes these demons, of course with a leer, not believing in such things himself, but Jesus precociously takes these demons and sends them into a bunch of beautiful little innocent pigs and races them down the hill to get drowned. What kind of morality is that? Your Jesus is immoral. It's actually a rather tough argument. But if the latest socio-political commentaries are right, and this was in fact a major military outpost, shock horror, and our evangelical tradition might find this hard to cope with, but is it not possible, and in fact Jesus was clearly showing that people were more important than pigs? Is it not possible that this was a very subtle attack on the meat market for the local military encampment? And if it was, would that not make more sense of the people being terrified? I could understand them being angry. I mean, they'd be checking out what they were going to lose in terms of the loss of their pigs. But the scriptures seem to indicate it was more than that. They were terrified. Would you be terrified to no longer have to cuddle your kids at night as this madman is shrieking up there in the tombs in the mountains? Go there and have a look at the terrain. It must have been terrifying for people trying to get their kids to bed at night when this man was going on one of his rages in the middle of those tombs. It would have echoed right down across the lake and across the valley. Would you be terrified when a man's sane? Why would you be terrified? Well, my friends, if any of you, like myself, have been to Central America or to any country where a dictatorship, a military dictatorship is ruling, you would know exactly why they would be terrified if this was a major military encampment and the meat market for that encampment was wiped out. You'd have every reason to want Jesus to get out of the way, because the reprisals would not be against Jesus. He'd hop in his boat and go back across the water. The reprisals would be clearly against the local residents. I don't know. I think that's a very reasonable proposition, and it certainly takes the winds out of Mr. Singer's sails, if it be true. But it is beautiful, isn't it? Here's a man who's dressed, who had been naked, who's restored to fellowship with others who before was socially intractable, who was at peace who before was tortured, who is sane who before was mad. And dear friends, if there's one thing about Western culture that I find so hard to cope with, it's conversations with intellectuals who would be happy if somebody believed in Abyssinian frog worship, if it did something psychologically for them, but if Jesus changes their lives, suddenly the academy can't cope with it. And there's a lot of that in this country. I had a Muslim friend recently said to me, I can't understand this country. He's talking about the UK. He said, this is supposed to be basically a Christian country, and yet your own people and will allow any sort of vilification of your faith. They will allow the most hurtful, the most insidious, the most wounding, the most ugly, the most humanly indifferent responses to the tenderest beliefs of the hearts of those of you who are true believers in Jesus. You're open game in your Christian country. And he's right. He's absolutely right. Isn't that true? Say something about the Muslims and see what happens on BBC. But you can do what you like with the Christians. And the sad thing is that for many, you can take a man who is a public enemy, who is tortured and broken and dangerous to the society, and if it is a simple faith in Jesus Christ that brings about a conversion, that new birth of which we sang tonight, then there are a lot of academics that immediately would be most upset and will even work, some of them, as social workers against the conversion of somebody who has found peace. But I know, and any of us who've been working in welfare for years, in our case, with probably the singly hardest kind of people that you could work with, I know that not once, not twice, hundreds of times, nay, thousands of times, one sees the tortured, broken, naked spirit of a human being brought to peace when they meet Jesus. I can argue the stuff a bit intellectually, but I tell you, there's no answer to what happens when someone is converted and they find the grace of God, their lives are totally changed. That's what we have here. Wesley said it long ago, my Methodist heritage has been mentioned, so let me just say this. I love, although I like jazz, I like blues, I like modern rock, but I can't get away from some of the great old hymns of Wesley's day. Ransomed, healed, restored, forgiven. How do you like those words out of a great old hymn that Anglicans and Methodists and Presbyterians used to sing? What words? Ransomed, healed, restored, forgiven. You tell me if that doesn't make a social difference to a society, if your neighbors, if all of you, are ransomed, healed, restored, forgiven. Give me a government policy that can ever do that for anybody. I want to finish with this. I'd like to spend an hour on this passage. It's hard to cover it in a short time. But for any of you tonight who don't know Jesus, I'd have to ask, why are you here? Are you here because the friendship of a believer was real enough for you to be willing to brook your normal interests and maybe what your friends got to say to take the risk to be with them tonight? Well, that says something in itself about the grace of God working through your friends. Are you here tonight because this place has a reputation for people's lives being changed and for being a place where there is good music, where there is a sense of art to what you're doing, but there is a faith and a meaningful something happening in the middle of such a quagmire of unbelief and lostness in your culture? You do wise to be here if that's the case. Do you come tonight because maybe, and this is most unlikely because I'm a stranger, but you've heard about a guy that goes to Greenbelt and it's a bit weird and different, so you thought you'd come to listen. Whatever you've come for here tonight, this story, take it away with you and recognize that the Jesus of the Bible has gone to every length that is possible, including his own death on the cross. That the Jesus of the Bible is beautifully set in this paradigm of crossing the lake to the other side. That Jesus loves you and will cross any lake, be it cultural, be it sin, be whatever it is. He loves you tonight. And this story certainly is not an unintelligent story. I mean, the world is crying out for some kind of reconciliation. The biggest single problem facing us now in the world is irreconcilable differences. Last week's Economist, did you read it? Asking whether we're going back to the Middle Ages, whether we're going to go way back to the days of the Crusades. Seriously, a major magazine on economics saying that the great thing that faces Europe and the Western world now is the question as to whether the hostility between Muslims and Christians will become the Third World War virtually. The Economist, not some apocalyptic sect magazine you pick up on the street corner from a long hair. The Economist. Is there anything bigger for the human race than reconciliation? And there is nothing more central to the story of Jesus than reconciliation, crossing lakes, giving his life, whatever is necessary. He will reach you if you'll let him. And to you believers, I got some bad news for you. Sorry about this. It's not really bad news, but it looks bad news. You see, if you were this man, and you'd just been transformed by Jesus, and Jesus hopping in the boat and saying, "See you later, mate," on his way back, what would you want to do? Wouldn't you want to go back across the lake with Jesus? Jesus says to his new convert, "I want you converted from your fear and your brokenness, but I don't want you out of this culture. I want a voice in the middle of the military encampment. I want a voice in the midst of all those who've known you for what you were before." And the sad thing, I think, is, and it's, I guess, a message for another day, is that somehow in the evangelical world, we really have gotten ensconced in comfort zone stuff. Wesley was a scholar at Oxford. Master of Arts wouldn't have been too bad at Oxford back then, I wouldn't think. Tutoring Greek. And God took that man and took him to the streets, the lanes, to the broken bottom end of the armpits of this country. And you know, the stories like that again and again and again. But we do like our comfort zones. It would have been much nicer to go back across the lake where there was nice, safe, Jewish regulations to life, where there weren't madmen running around behaving like this. And the sad thing is that I think that most of us, when we get people converted, enculturate them into a Christian subculture. And the better our church is, and the nicer its music, and the more it fulfills us theologically, the more the danger will be that we will not deliberately cross the lake with Jesus again and again to those who are in it. I'm not talking about having one or two bright lights in your church, especially do that. I'm saying that every one of you walk these streets. Every one of you sees someone on the gutter. Every one of you sees someone that's destitute from one week to another. What do you do about it? I'm not saying we should vacate the university. I'm not saying we should vacate the business luncheon. But I am saying that we need to keep crossing the lake with Jesus. We need to get out of the comfort zones. We need to go through the stormy weather, which began in the paradigm Mark gives us. They get in the boat, they go to the other side, and they hit a storm. It's stormy business when you get out of the safety and security of your own culture. You don't have to go as a missionary to the hippies. You can do it by going around the corner to the highest class pub in London, if you like. I've been to one or two where I frankly felt so outclassed, even in a suit, that I wondered if I was in the right place. But do you do that, my friends, you believers? There surely is nothing on the horizon of philosophy or social theory in the Western world that remotely looks like it can even converse with the problem, let alone bring an answer. If ever there was an hour for believers in Jesus, it's now, from the academy to the gutter. If we're there, if we relieve the safety and security of where we are. But as we finish, those of you that don't know him, maybe tonight, just in some little way, you've picked up the sense of the divine imperative, the divine compassion, the seeking heart that wants to reach you tonight. There's a good team here. They would love to pray with you. They know how to do that. They've been trained, not as professionals, you know, but as people that care, that wanted to get the act together so they'd know how to lead someone to Jesus. If you came here tonight with some kind of seeking, then you don't have to leave without some kind of finding. It's simple as that. And as we sing the last hymn, maybe you could do a little sending up of a message or two to God yourself. But I want to pray just a little prayer. It's a prayer for you in which you may enter in. I will say we, and you can be part of the we of this prayer if you wish. And if tonight you say one of two things, as an unbeliever, you say, I want to know a God, I want to feel that God, I want to have the sense of the companionship of that God in my life. Then why don't you at the end of the service come forward, just kneel at the cushions here. We're going to try and make sure other people don't rush us up here. And there will be somebody who can sit with you and pray with you. And put your hand into his hand. Maybe he's crossed the lake for you tonight. And maybe there's a believer here tonight, because believers need a certain converting very often too. And maybe there's one of you tonight, you feel the niggling of that, and you know that God is saying to you, it's time that the business of bringing the gospel to a broken world was really central to my life and not just a peripheral activity. And maybe there's a need tonight for some of us to obey the Lord. And we need to come in repentance too. Maybe we need a fellow sister or brother to sit with us and pray with us, because the comfort zone stuff still limits the possibilities of the goodness of what God could do through our lives. And if you want that tonight, you could come for prayer as well. I know you're English, but I'm going to suggest you hold hands. In solidarity tonight that we seek the Lord, let's hold one another's hands. If you're not a believer, then pray with me. Feel the significance of that life next to you, because the God of the universe came in the person of Jesus Christ, crossed every lake imaginable, and died on a cross. That means that person next to you is not just another Londoner or whatever. That person next to you is the object of the divine grace of the eternal God that is totally self-giving in his determination to reach. The person on either side of you is of immense significance, and you are of the same significance.